Good evening. I do a series of lessons back in Bull Verde that fall into the category of what we call Mark's musings. Because sometimes I just look at the scriptures and I just think, well, I wonder how this came down or how this happened. What was going on at this particular time? And as I think about that particular thing, I think about Peter and what clearly must have been one of the most exciting moments in anybody's life in the scriptures would have been when Peter stepped out of a boat and began to walk on water. Do you ever think, what's going through Peter's mind? How incredible must that have been as Jesus called him and he stepped out of the boat and started walking on water and defied everything he would have ever known before, especially as a fisherman. I'm thinking more than once. Had he been in the water, obviously, and he understood the way that the forces of nature worked, and you step out into the water and you sink. But he started walking on water. But then he did start to sink. And he started to sink because it says he saw the wind and the waves. He saw Jesus to start with, but then he saw the wind and the waves and he started to sink. That's what we talked about yesterday. The idea of the assaults on marriage. We started yesterday morning talking about just getting distracted. Sometimes Satan gets us distracted. Sometimes we just look the wrong direction. Maybe we focus on our children. Maybe we find ourselves wrapped up in the technology, or it could be other things. We may find ourselves wrapped up in work or wrapped up in some kind of hobby or anything else. And we just, maybe we just see how that starts to affect marriage because we lose time together and we start to possibly drift apart a little bit and something has to be done. And then we talked last night about slammed against the house because sometimes he comes with an all-out frontal attack that he's going to attack us based on the culture that we live in. He's going to attack us based on the idea of trying to get us to be tempted with doing things that would bring about even the severing sometimes of a marriage relationship. And so as we battle these storms, as we battle the idea of the assaults that are on marriage, we talked about being distracted and being destroyed both because Satan seeks both of those. Tonight, we're going to look at a lesson that's going to direct us towards, so what do you do when you drift apart? Maybe it's just something simple. Maybe, as we said, you just kind of drift apart and you've just got to make up for some lost time. Maybe there's been some things that have offended one or the other. Maybe already because you've sacrificed time, maybe one of the partners feels slighted. Maybe because you've so preoccupied yourself with the children and have changed from husband or wife mode into parent mode that somebody in the marriage feels neglected. And all of those things have an effect, and sometimes they have a cumulative effect, or sometimes maybe it is something that is significantly more of an issue than that. Maybe somebody has done something that has greatly offended. Maybe somebody in the relationship has been or feels betrayed, and that's difficult because in a marriage relationship, if there's anybody that should be primarily interested in our well-being emotionally, physically, spiritually, anybody on earth, it ought to be our spouse. And yet, sometimes, as the saying goes, you hurt those that are closest to you. And so we're going to talk about tonight the idea of repairing storm damage. What do you do when, whether it's been a little bit of neglect or something else comes into the relationship and you find out that we've got a little bit of a rift here. We've got a little bit of a separation. We have something we've got to repair, or we've got this great divide because it is something significant. How do we repair the storm damage? A couple of things that I think are very important for us to keep in mind. You cannot overemphasize the point in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31 and 32, that marriage is a model of Christ and the church. And I'll tell you, for me, you couldn't, as I said, possibly overemphasize that, because I can tell you I didn't come out of a household or out of a lifestyle that was godly. I came out of exactly the opposite of that, the picture of a broken home, with alcoholism and abuse and all that went with that. And some of my best friends, the guy that lived down the street from me that was a good friend, and the guy across the street from me that was a good friend, their families looked a lot like mine did. And so I just thought that's what family was. I thought that's how people dealt with one another. I thought it was interesting. Judy and I had not been married very long when she made a statement and said, "I never heard my parents argue." I thought, wow. I always heard my parents argue. More my dad than anything else. And it wasn't even just arguing. I grew up hearing screaming and yelling and abusiveness in the way of verbal and emotional, even physical. And so all of that was going on. And that wasn't what I saw. She grew up in a different kind of home than I did. And then I bumped into somebody that I had known already, but we became very, very good friends in high school. And I spent a lot of time in his house and found out, you know what, his family's different than ours. And he tried to teach me the gospel for over 3 years. I would like to think that I have a relatively decent level of intelligence, but he spent 3 years trying to teach me, and Judy would tell you that had little to do with ability to understand, much more to do with I might be a little stubborn from time to time. And so I just wasn't ready to give up what I was doing. It wasn't horrendous things, but I wasn't willing to give that up. I knew if I was going to commit to Christ, I had to give up the life that was focused on me. But eventually, even though he was trying to teach me, I understood the truth long before I responded to it. That's not to my credit or my glory. That's just saying I was putting that off. I wasn't ready to commit. I understood the truth. But eventually, as I looked at his family, I thought, whatever causes this, his family, to be different than the family I always knew, whatever is causing that, that's what I want in my life. And that was God. That was Jesus Christ. And so you cannot overemphasize this, because people in the world are looking at your marriage. They're looking at my marriage, and we may not understand that, but we are trying to portray to the world the relationship of Jesus Christ and his church. That's critical that we understand that that's what we're portraying to the world. So you can't overemphasize that. And so what do you learn? You ever think about that? So how is marriage going to help me understand Christ's relationship with his church? How's it going to help me to understand that? Because it isn't just Ephesians 5. All through the Old Testament, God uses the analogy of being married to his people. He talks about his people as being a bride back in the Old Testament. God says, "I will rejoice over you like a bridegroom rejoices over his bride." That's what he said through Isaiah. In the prophet Hosea, he says, "You'll no longer call me my master. You will call me husband." Totally different connotation there. He was still their master, but he says, "I want you to get a different picture of me. Call me husband." All throughout the New Testament, Jesus talks about that, doesn't he? And even on the negative side, when God referred to the people of the world or the people of his nation, his people, when they turned their back on him, what did he address them as? He said, "You're an adulterous generation. You're an adulterous people. We're supposed to be married. You're supposed to be faithful to me, but you are not." He uses that analogy throughout the Bible. And that's important that we grasp that he's using that analogy. So what do I learn? What do I learn about God? Because I'm married. You ever think about that? Just because I'm married, what can I learn about God? Dr. Ed Wheat, who's written a couple of very good books, but he wrote The First Years of Forever. And he writes this: "Marriage becomes a series of surprises for most of us." True? I always ask people, I say, how many of you learned something about your spouse after you got married you didn't know before you got married? Oh, we can probably all raise our hand to that one. How many of you learned something about yourself after you got married you didn't know before you got married? Oh, the hand goes up there too. Because we learn some things about ourselves because of the relationship. He says, "Marriage becomes a series of surprises for most of us, and one of them is how frequently we need to forgive and be forgiven." And I would tell you that we learn something about our relationship with God and the idea of forgiveness. What's it like for God to be married to you? And to be married to me? How many times has my God had to forgive me once I was in the relationship with him? Now, I lived a life apart from God first. And I understand that when I went down into the waters of baptism and was raised up based on my faith that Jesus Christ was who he says he is, the Son of God, and I was finally ready to commit my life to God, when I came up out of the waters of baptism, I understand those sins were gone absolutely, completely out of my life. And since then, I've just been the perfect Christian. Is that the way it works? Well, it doesn't work that way, does it? My God's had to forgive me again and again and again. That's the nature of our relationship. I would tell you, so much so, and so important is the concept of forgiveness, that there is no relationship that can be sustained without it. You can start a relationship, you cannot sustain a relationship, whether you're talking God to man, or whether you are talking man to man, brother to brother, brother to sister, husband to wife, parent to child, whatever it is, employee to employer or fellow employees. If a relationship is going to be sustained, there's going to have to be forgiveness. Why is that? Why is it that forgiveness is so critical in marriage? Because marriage is the union of two sinful people, and sinful people wound each other. That's just the facts. It'd be great if I had been perfect and Judy had been perfect. Neither one of us had ever done anything or ever said anything since we've been married that was wrong. But that's not the truth. We know forgiveness is needed. So it becomes extremely important to see this, and for a couple of reasons. One, it elevates marriage. When I picture marriage and understand it has a higher purpose than my happiness, that it isn't all about my happiness. Does God want me to be happy? He does. But I tell you, primarily God wants us to be holy. He wants that more than anything else. And that's the higher purpose. It elevates marriage to say, I'm trying to show the world what it's like to be married to Jesus Christ, what his relationship with his church is like. I'm trying to portray that. When I marry two people, I guess I shouldn't say I marry two people. I perform the ceremony. If I married two people, that'd be bigamy. So when I perform a ceremony for somebody, before I do that, we go through some premarital counseling classes. And I ask them to write down the top three reasons that they want to marry this person. Every time I ask them to write that down. And I want to use that. I want to be able to maybe work it into the ceremony itself. And you get most of the standard things. People will talk about somebody's sense of humor. They'll talk about the spiritual nature of the person and how that person's encouraging and helps them. A lot of different things. I've never, ever had somebody put down on the sheet, I want to marry this person because I know they're not perfect and I know that they are going to do something to aggravate me and they're going to help me become a better forgiver than I am now. Would you list that as one of the top three reasons you got married? I think that I'm going to become a better forgiver. I had a good friend that got married, or was getting married, and a common friend of ours, we're all sitting together, and he said, I'm going to pray for you when you get married. And my good friend said, what are you going to pray? That was typical. If you told him, I'm going to pray for you, you need to be ready to answer what you're praying, because he's always going to ask you that. What are you going to pray for me, he said. The other guy, and all three of us are now preachers, but the other guy says, I'm going to pray that the two of you have sufficient troubles in your marriage to make you a stronger person. I was a new Christian. I thought, don't pray for me when I get married. I don't need that kind of help. But James says that we should count it joy when we have these various trials because it does make us stronger. And we become better forgivers. I understand something about what does it take for God to forgive me when I transgress him? What does it take? Because he says that picture of what he's doing for me needs to be portrayed here too, in this relationship here. And that becomes important. So it elevates marriage. Secondly, it places marriage firmly on the basis of grace. It helps us to understand that nature of forgiveness is what allows that relationship to continue on and on. How does it last a lifetime? Because there is the ability to forgive and reconcile. If you cannot have forgiveness and reconciliation in a relationship, it cannot endure. Period. We understand that. The moment God stops forgiving us, what happens to our relationship? It would cease to exist. We understand that. And he says marriage becomes a picture very much the same way. And it becomes then the doing and the display of God. I'm doing what he asked me to do, and I'm showing the world what it's like to be married to God. How critical is our marriage? It's critical because of what we're showing the world. So as we think about that, then we understand. My job in a marriage is to be a pointer. The same as it is in life. I mean, you remember what Paul said? Paul said in Philippians, here's what the goal of my life is, Paul said. Philippians chapter 1. He said, the goal is that I might magnify Christ, whether by life or by death. Either way, you remember when he said, for me to live is Christ, but to die is gain, but to live is Christ? He says, before that, he says, my job here is to magnify Christ. Whether I'm living or dying, it doesn't make any difference. As long as somebody sees Jesus Christ better because of who I am and what I'm doing. We understand that. That's the purpose even of coming together as Christians. Is it not to stimulate one another to do those kinds of things? If we go out of here this week and everybody forgets who even preached this week, that really doesn't matter. Well, with the exception of my wife. She needs to remember me because I'm going home with her. Yeah, I mean, does it matter if you remember me or not? No. You know what matters? Was Christ glorified? Do I see Christ a little better this week? Do I understand something about my God a little better this week? That's the key. Anytime that we talk about God's Word, that He is glorified. And that's what Paul said. So we're a pointer. Always view your marriage as a pointer to the relationship that Christ has with His church. So look at Colossians chapter 2 with me. We're going to see that that's exactly what happens. That we're picturing something. Because between Colossians chapter 2 and chapter 3, he's going to talk about the nature of forgiveness, but he's going to transfer where it's coming from and where it's going to. Now, he's not going to be talking, when we get to Colossians 3, specifically about marriage. He's talking about Christians in general, but the application is still there. But in Colossians chapter 2, he says, let's talk about what's happened for you. Starting in verse 12, he says, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in powerful working of God, who raised him from the dead, and you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by, he says, canceling the record of debt that stood against us with his legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. That is a great picture. When you talk about grace received, he says, let me tell you what God did for us. When you came up out of the waters of baptism, or every time that Christ forgives you, God forgives you. Every time, not just at the baptism, but every time. He said, here's the nature of the forgiveness of God. Because this is what makes it hard. He says the forgiveness of God is a canceling of a debt. It's a canceling of a debt. It's like you've got the piece of paper there. It's almost as if God's saying, you know what? There it is. There's your sins. I'm just going to erase them off the paper. He says, but he didn't just cancel the debt. He nailed it to the cross. It's I'm erasing off the paper. I'm going to wad the paper up and I'm going to throw the paper in the trash can. It's gone. And he uses other descriptions. He says, as far as east is from west. That's how far God removes us from our trespasses when he forgives us. As far as east is from west. Or he says he throws them into the depths of the sea. You ever think about that? I mean, that's an incredible picture. Mount Everest is, what, 28,000 feet, give or take? 28,000 feet. Incredible, incredible mountain. You could cast Mount Everest into the Marianas Trench in the sea, and it would miss the bottom by a mile. So when God says, I'm throwing him into the depths of the sea, isn't it interesting? He didn't say, I remove him as far as the highest mountain. He says, you know, the highest mountain is not quite a good enough picture. Let me tell you about the depths of the sea. And so as I cast him into the depths of the sea, he says, that's our sins. The picture of that is in Luke 15, when the prodigal returns home. Or maybe I should say the younger prodigal. I think it's always important to realize there were two prodigals in that parable. Just different ways. But the younger prodigal comes home, who had wasted all that money. And he had prepared that big speech that he was going to give to his dad. And he started that speech. Father, I've sinned against you. And his father's just like, whoa, stop right there. He says, let me put a robe on your back. Let me put a ring on your finger. Let me kill the fatted calf. Let me throw a party like no other party, because my son was dead and now he is alive. He says that's the picture of forgiveness, the totality of it, the ability to completely remove it. That son came back home repentant and God forgave him, or the father in that picture forgave him. He says that's the picture. That's what God has done for us. Well, so he talks about in chapter 3 who we are and why this should matter. So look at verse 12 of chapter 3. Put on then as Christ, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. Now, that's a great passage. He says, look who we are. We are chosen. We are holy. We are the beloved of God. He says, that's who we are. Understand who you are first. And so who am I when I'm married? I mean, clearly I'm my wife's husband. But he says, don't ever forget who you are. You are a child of God. A child of God. We used to tell our boys, when you leave the house, I might ask them, what's your name? Now, of course, it wasn't the only times, but it was one of the times they looked at me like I'd lost it already. You know, and this is before I reached my 60s, and so they had already thought, Dad's losing it. But they might say, Daniel, or Jonathan, or Matthew. I'd say, what's your whole name? I might say, Matthew Broyles. And I said, that's the important part. Understand, every time you walk out of this house, you don't just carry your name, you carry my name. And that's the picture God's trying to give us. He says, understand who you are. Who you are. Remember when David committed the sin with Bathsheba? Nathan came and told him that horrific story, and David got all upset about it until he found out it was him, and then he turned to repent. But you remember what Nathan said? He was going to lose that child. He was going to lose that child. Why? Because he committed adultery? That isn't what Nathan said. Because he committed conspiracy to murder? That isn't what Nathan said. Those were horrific things to do. But Nathan said, because you have given occasion to the enemy to blaspheme the name of God. That's how serious that is. So what does the world see in my marriage? Am I bringing God glory? Or am I painting a picture of God that is not true? By way of forgiveness, what is it that I'm painting? I need to show that. Marriage is grace bent forward. All I am doing is taking what God has given to me, and I'm trying to demonstrate it in this relationship here, because it is a picture of this relationship here. He said, so whatever God provides in this relationship is what he's asking me to provide in this relationship. He says, that's the nature of who we are. And so did you notice in that passage? He kind of identifies several things. He says you've got some attitude leading to behavior. There's some things that he says you experience in this passage. And so he would have us to understand things such as, so how do, when you're elect, when you're the holy of God, when you're a chosen one, how do you dress? In other words, what do you put on your life? How do you clothe yourself? What does that look like? What does it look like when I'm trying to show the world who God is? He says there are some things that we have in that relationship. He says compassionate hearts responds with kindness. You know why Jesus did what he did for all the people that he did it for when he looked out on the crowds? It said about him repeatedly, he had compassion on them. This is what he felt. He says, and if this is what I feel, then this is what I do. And he displayed that kind of kindness toward those around him. He talks about having humility. Humility. He said, so you have a humility. He says, then that's demonstrated in the meekness with which you approach people. How do I talk to my wife? How do I speak? He's not talking about weak. We'll see that tomorrow when we talk about the things that God wants you to instill in your children, tomorrow and Wednesday. But he says, I understand who I am. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That's the humility. I understand who I am. Well, if I understand who I am, that I am a person who has sinned and has only got the relationship that I have because of the grace of God, I can't brag about that. That's why Paul and others said, you can't boast about that. How can you boast because somebody gave you a gift? He says, you can't. You demonstrate meekness because of the humility. And then he talks about patience. The idea really there is long suffering. Willing, it's not the patience of something that is very quick. It's not that patience that just immediately responds. You know, you ever been in the grocery store? Come around the corner and you, grocery store you shop at regularly? And you just know certain cashiers are faster than others, and so you're eyeing the line. And then you get in line, you realize, are you kidding me? It says right there, 15 items or less, and I counted that cart in front of me. They got 17 items there. You ever done that? Just patient? You know, we demonstrate impatience. So how about on the road? You ever been impatient on the road? I've told Judy more than once, if they'd give me the ability to revoke 6 licenses a day, the roads would be a lot better place. They won't. Because I can get impatient. You ever been there? I love one guy. He said his car stalled at a red light. He said, I was trying my best to start it. The guy behind me just kept honking and honking. He said, I'm trying to start the car. I don't know what to do. I'm trying to start it. He said, finally, he says, I got out of my car, walked back to the car behind me, tapped on his window. He rolled it down. I said, look, do me a favor. If you can go up and try and start my car, I'll honk your horn for you. How patient are we? How patient are we? But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about long suffering, endurance. It's going to take a lifetime of it. When we talk about Job, we sometimes talk about the patience of Job, but the word that's used there is not patience. It's endurance. I mean, it was not a just one-time thing and you get over it. It was having to endure a life-changing event. And he says for us that we have to do that. And so what happens is there's two different things that he says in that passage, not one. Did you notice that? He uses two different words. He talks about forgiveness and forbearance. Forgiveness and forbearance. What does that mean? The idea of forgiveness and forbearance. Well, we understand forgiveness. That's because there has been an offense, and now it's my response to the offense. Whatever it is, we talked about, it may be a minor thing. There is a video ad that was run by JCPenney several years ago called In the Doghouse. And it's just all about husbands who bought bad gifts for their wives on their anniversary. And so they actually go through and fall in a doghouse and end up folding laundry for the rest of their lives. But it's just, you know, it may be a minor offense. And we understand that. And the guy that falls into the doghouse bought his wife a vacuum cleaner for their anniversary. Didn't go over real well. He said, I got you the best model. It's a dual bag. Still didn't make any difference, did it? I like when you think about, sometimes it's small offenses. I actually like the lady who said, my husband got me a mood ring for our anniversary. She said, when I'm in a good mood, it turns green. When I'm in a bad mood, it leaves a red mark on his forehead. How do we respond? Because forgiveness is needed. And we understand those are just humorous things, but they're small things. But forgiveness can be much larger than that. And so he says, we do have to forgive. But what happens is, forbearance first acknowledges that there are going to be offenses. That's what he's saying. You're going to have to forbear with one another. Christians, if you expect everybody around you to always be perfect, you're in a world of trouble because it's not going to work that way. People are going to say things and do things. People are going to be grumpy from time to time. That's life. That doesn't mean it's excusable. What it's saying is you have to understand that. It's like raising children, is it not? If you don't think your children are going to make mistakes, if you don't think they're going to show irresponsibility, you're in for a world of pain in trying to raise them. You don't have to excuse the behavior. It's just saying you understand certain things will happen. Why? Because they're children. Well, because we're married. Forbearance acknowledges that there will be sins in the relationship. But then forgiveness cancels out the debt that is owed. It cancels it out. I want to read you just real quickly a little article a guy wrote called The Compost Pile. He said, what about the compost pile? Picture your marriage as a grassy field. You enter it at the beginning full of hope and joy. You look out into the future and you see beautiful flowers and trees and rolling hills. And the beauty is what you see in each other. Your relationship is the field and the flowers and the rolling hills. But before long, you begin to step in cow pies. Some seasons of your marriage, they may seem to be everywhere. Late at night, they're especially prevalent. These are the sins and the flaws and the idiosyncrasies and the weaknesses and annoying habits in you and your spouse. You try to forgive them and endure them with grace. But they have a way of dominating the relationship. It may not even be true, but it feels that that's all there is sometimes. I think the combination of forbearance and forgiveness leads to the creation of a compost pile. And here you begin to shovel the cow pies. You look at each other and simply admit that there are a lot of cow pies. But you say to each other, you know there's more to this relationship than the pies. And we're losing sight of that because we keep focusing on the pies. Let's throw them all in a compost pile. And then we're going to walk away from that pile and set our eyes on the rest of the field. We'll pick some favorite paths and hills that we know are not strewn with the pies. And we'll be thankful for the part of the field that is sweet. Our hands may be dirty, our backs may ache from all the shoveling, but one thing we know, we will not pitch our tent by the compost pile. This is the gift of grace that we will give each other again and again and again because we are chosen, holy, and loved by God. I like that little writing. He's just saying, it's so easy to get hung up on the flaws and on the mistakes. He says, we've got to find a way to forgive somebody. And you realize one of the vows that most of us take at a wedding ceremony deals with this very concept? In our vows, it was there. Did anybody ever say, from this day forward? You ever think about what that vow means? From this day forward. Because there's already going to be a vow that says, until death do we part. From this day forward is not talking about how long. From this day forward is talking about how it's going to change. Tomorrow is not going to be exactly the same as today. Next year is not going to be the same as this year. There's going to be changes all throughout. You're going to change. I'm going to change. I tell people Judy's been married 4 times. All of them are me. Because I'm not the same as I was at 20. I'm not the same as I was at 30 or 40. We change. And you have to understand that that happens from this day forward. And it requires the ability to cancel the debts that are there. Throw them on the compost pile. Take that person and hold on to them. And then just these points simply as we close tonight. Here's the difficulty. Because forgiveness is not easy. It's not easy. It's not easy to ask for it. It's not easy to extend it. It's tough. When you look at the picture of God's forgiveness toward us, and you look at what Paul said, because Paul said in statement form in Colossians 3, what Jesus said in question form, or request form before God in Matthew 6. Paul said, forgive as Christ has forgiven you. All right, just keep that phrase in your mind for a minute. As Christ has forgiven you. In Matthew 6, it's kind of flipped because he says, here's how you ought to pray. God, forgive us as we have forgiven those who are indebted to us. You ever think about that phrase? As. So here's what I'm asking God. God, I just want you to forgive me the same way I forgive others. It's not talking about frequency only. It's talking about manner as well. Forgive as I forgive others. How good are you at forgiving? Because that's what you're asking God. That's a dangerous prayer. You ever think about that? God, I want you to forgive me exactly the same way I forgive. Well, that's what Paul is telling us. He's saying, I want you to forgive exactly as Christ forgives. There's a totality to that. And that makes it hard. So if you're asking for forgiveness, it requires humility. It's tough to go to your spouse and say, I was wrong. I offended you. That's tough. It's always tough to acknowledge that you were at fault. But to ask forgiveness requires that. Pride can get in the way so easily. so easily and destroy the relationship. I need to ask forgiveness, which requires humility. So, some things to think about that. Ask for the gift. Ask for it. Unconditional apology. No caveats on apology. You ever hear caveats on apology? How about, well, you want to see caveats, let your children get in trouble. You know, our boys, we have three boys, so as you might expect, they would occasionally get into some scuffles. And I waited for the time that I could walk into the room and have one of them say to me, "Dad, he hit me." And I'd say, "Did you hit him?" And that brother would say, "Yes, I did. I am profoundly sorry. I didn't have any real reason to hit him. I am begging for your forgiveness, and I am begging for his forgiveness as well. Would you please help me get past this?" Well, good luck with that. I never had a child say that. Every time I went, "Did you hit him?" "Yes, but." There you go, right? "Oh, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't have hit him if he hadn't hit me first. Or if he hadn't have..." There's that caveat. Are you sorry? Are you not sorry? You know, "I'm sorry you feel that way." There's a caveat. "I'm sorry. You know what? If you were a stronger person, if you had a little more to you, it wouldn't have bothered you so bad. So it's not my fault. It's your fault." All the caveats we can attach. "I'm sorry" is the whole statement you need. "I am sorry, period, for what I did. I'm sorry. It was what I did that I'm apologizing for." That doesn't mean the other person doesn't have anything to apologize for. They may. But I can't apologize for them. It needs to be without caveat, unconditional. "I am truly sorry for what I did." Secondly, follow up with action. I need to demonstrate to them that I'm trying to change. You know, you can't, as one brother to the other, say, "I'm sorry I hit him, but if he does that again, I'm going to whack him again." Well, what's the purpose of the apology? You have to follow it up with action. I need to change. If I said something offensive, I need to work on that. If I did something offensive, I need to work on that. And then give time for healing. Sometimes we apologize to people and we think they should just be all better. I'm telling you, if our boys got in a fight and one of them happened to punch the other one, which rarely happened because they knew. The rule in our house was you can wrestle, just take it outside and wrestle if you want to work it out that way. But if you hit, I get to fight the winner. That never goes well for them. And so rarely would they do that. But if you punch your brother in the nose, you can apologize all you want. His nose doesn't stop hurting. You've got to give time for healing. You can't just immediately forget everything. It doesn't just all go away. There's time involved to heal. And so you have to give that time for healing. So what about granting forgiveness? That requires strength. It's not easy to forgive somebody because there's a part of us that's crying out for justice. We may not even want revenge. We just want justice. They should have to pay for what they did. Something should happen to them for what they did, more than them just apologizing. The older brother in the story of the prodigal would have loved had that gone differently and something great had been demanded maybe of the other son. But it wasn't. Just apologize and I have to forgive you, and we have to find a way. That takes strength to do that. But you have to make a choice. It isn't based on how you feel. Nobody's going to say you feel like apologizing. I am thankful that my God's forgiveness of me is not based on his emotional state. Now, I don't mean to say by that he's in a bad emotional state like we get into. But I'm saying God doesn't forgive me because he says, "You know what, I just feel like forgiving Mark." He forgives me because he is God and he is faithful to the promise that he's made that he'll do it when I come back to him. That's why he does it. We know we can anger God, we can grieve God, we can upset God, but he doesn't base his actions on those feelings. He does what he says he'll do. Don't base it on your feelings. It's a choice you have to make. Secondly, you need to share your hurt. If you're going to grant forgiveness, let the other person know what hurt and how it hurt. They need to know that. They need to understand what it is they've done, why it hurt you so badly, how you felt about that, so that they can react to that. And it allows you to be able to vent that and to discharge that. This is what it made me feel like. This is what happened. And then thirdly, stop the video. Stop the video. You know what that means? Don't keep hitting that replay button. It's like, "Oh, you know what? Let me rewind that. Boom. Let's watch that again. Let's watch that one again. Let me tell you again what happened here." Stop the video. We don't need the recording. Forgiveness is an act, and we have to extend the forgiveness. Is it easy? No, it is not easy. It requires great strength. And depending on what it is that has happened, it may require a good deal of time for the healing. You can't just... You hear people say forgive and forget. I always offer the same advice for that. Good luck. Because we don't have the capacity to forget the way that we're talking about there. You can't just forget. I'll no longer hold it to their charge. But I don't know about you. People I forgave from way back in my past, I can still remember what happened. I don't have the ability to discharge it from my mind. It's still there. It's an erasure of the debt. It's not a forgetting the memory. If I wanted to recall it, I could. What he says is if you forgave the person, you don't recall it. You don't bring it up. You don't address it again because you've canceled it. It's no longer valid, but you don't forget it. It just doesn't work that way. Just understand. Because of that, forgiveness is an act of will. I forgive because God tells me to forgive. Trust is not equated with forgiveness. If I have violated my wife's trust, and I've violated my wife's trust again and again, or a child to a parent, or however you're looking at that, trust has to be rebuilt. That takes some time. Forgiveness is granted. It doesn't mean you put the other person at ease. And I'll just close with this. I had a good friend who ruined his marriage and his family by having an extramarital affair. And his wife took him back, and he had another extramarital affair that lasted a long period of time that he wasn't willing to leave, and so his wife wouldn't take him back. And so the first time when she took him back, he thought, she has forgiven me. This should never bother her anymore. Well, just imagine that you're the spouse. You think you forget that because you forgave somebody? Just the next day, everything's okay? And one guy described it this way, and for me it was the best description. Because we were in Kansas City at that time, spent 21 years there. He said, I want you to envision your driveway being iced over. You ever had that happen here? Your driveway has a sheet of ice on it. He says, and your mailbox is at the end of the driveway. He said, I want you to picture yourself walking out to your mailbox to get the mail. Oh, I've done that. You ever done that? You don't walk the same way. If there's nothing on the driveway, you just walk out there lickety-split. But the ice is on there, and you're taking little tiny steps, and you're trying to be extra cautious. Because the whole time, what are you waiting for? You're waiting for the step that's going to cause the fall to come. He said, that's how your wife feels, or that's how your spouse feels. That's how they feel. They can't just release that yet because they're waiting for that bomb to drop. You've got to give time. Give time for healing. But have the strength to grant the forgiveness and rebuild the trust. The great promise that God makes to us is exactly what he said in Colossians chapter 2. Dead in trespasses, but forgave. Canceled that debt. That's what he does for everybody that comes to him. We hope if you've never come to him before, you do that tonight. Make your life right with God. If you don't know how to do that, please talk to us. We'd love to share out of his word what he says about that. For those of us that are Christians, well, we've just got a great chance now to show the world what a great forgiver God is by the way we forgive our spouse in our relationship. If we can help you respond to God's call, let us know while we stand and sing.